Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Hello friends, I'm your host, Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Gentlemen, how are we doing?
Good, thanks.
Yes, I'm looking at you, John. Drink it. Are you drinking water? Is it going to start coming out the hose like in the Carry On films?
Yeah. My T-shirt's starting to get damp.
Yes. How's your recovery doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Went into hospital almost 2 weeks ago now and had stripped a big line of nerves out of the back of my right leg and put them in my shoulder. And hopefully that means I'll be able to use my bicep in a few months' time. So right now I'm just in a sling and I can't really move my right arm for another 2 weeks, which is frustrating. I can't really do a lot at the moment, but recovering and very lucky for it only to be not a simple fix, but lucky that it wasn't any worse, put it that way.
That's still a fair bit of damage though, isn't it?
Yeah, so the one in my leg was pretty much fine. It just went through the muscle and back out, but the one in my shoulder basically snapped the nerve that goes to my bicep. So, but I mean, the doctor, the guy in Glasgow, brilliant doctor. He kind of said if it had been a centimeter further over, I'd have been fine. But if it had been the other side, I would have died of blood loss from being hit in the artery. So, got to take the positives.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. It's like pros and cons. Is the pro being that you're still alive, the con being that the shoulder for paddling is quite an important part of your body.
Yes, and
Ian, welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, no, thank you. It's an absolute honour that you've come on the show. Friends at home, John and Ian, both former Royal Marines. There they were paddling down the Amazon one day, as you do, when they got attacked by drunken pirates and had a bit of a scrap. And if you're not aware, it's been all over the media. And poor old John, in battling this pirate off, managed to get winged twice. And before we go into that part of the story, do you want to give us some background on your time in the Corps?
Yeah, sure. So I did 11 years, mostly just serving in sort of humanitarian stuff. So I was lucky or unlucky to not sort of serve in any real war-torn terrain. John and I were sort of landing craftsmen, so kind of boat specialists, and we met in the Indian Ocean. And yeah, I did 11 years and John did roughly 9, I think. And
was that the anti-piracy stuff you were doing when you met?
It was Diego Garcia, so it's a little bit of a touchy subject politically because it's the native people from the islands were kind of ousted out of them for, I guess, global security, if you like, but an American global security. But it is what it is, and there's not much to comment on that really, as to the right and wrongs.
Yeah, Diego was always the dream draft, wasn't it? Well, I mean, it was when I served. I left in 95. It's military police seemed to get that draft for some reason. Was that doing the customs role or something?
Yeah, that's it. So they had the lots of military police. Well, not lots. There's only, I think, 40 British personnel and roughly knocking on to 2,000 American and a lot of kind of Filipino helpers. But we had the British police via the by the military, and we had sort of general duties guys that would go over and help with the customs. And then there were a few of us landing craftsmen that would basically operate the boats in the whole archipelago, which is roughly 500,000 square kilometers or something like that, square miles even. And we would go around and kind of police the islands, make sure there's no illegal fishing. So it's incredible nature going on there. It's just, you know, amazing in being able to snorkel and then walk across the islands and, you know, try and stop these sort of illegal fishermen. So that was an amazing part of the job.
And is it the Indian Ocean, or am I miles off?
It is, yeah. Yeah, in the Indian Ocean, exactly. Yeah, so right in your left shoulder, pretty much in your left armpit at the moment.
Don't make me start pointing. I always get it wrong. Is it like... There, folks, all right?
It's somewhere there.
Yes. And John, how was your time served?
Good, yeah. I ended up in 3 years GD, which was a bit frustrating. I was trying to get an LC course straight away because I always loved being out in the water, and for whatever reason, it didn't happen. So I got pretty frustrated early on in my career. And then once Diego, which is still is the draft to get, once that was out of the way, I was kind of ready to leave. But I had a nice time. It was great. Met a lot of really good lads. And I guess I wanted a career in which I could go on expeditions. You can't really do that within the Corps and go away for 6 months, and make your own decisions within that 6 months. So that's why I ended up leaving.
There's a definite thing, isn't there? Blokes that serve, they say the actual average term is 7 years. That's what I did. But I think 7 to 11, it captures those people that want the experience of being in the Marines and the challenge and travel the world a bit, see things go bang. But then there's a lot of other stuff they want to do in their life. Is it something like that?
Pretty much, yeah. Like, I don't want to, I feel like I maybe downtrodden it a bit there. Like, it was an amazing eight and a half years, but like purely through meeting the lads, like the bootnecks that you meet, and then you go on from that and end up doing expeditions with somebody like Jan. And so, yeah, I was just kind of, I suppose I'd had my time, and there was also nothing going on at the time between 2013 and 21 when I left. There's very little for the Corps to do during that time, so I guess a lot of lads were kind of just waiting for it, for something to kick off, and it never did. And I thought that was time to make something kick off myself. And that was,
guys, can you explain the Jan thing as opposed to the Ian?
I don't know. I guess from a sort of teenage or young age, some people would call me Jan, as in, you know, if I'm in France, I get called Jan. If you know, wherever I go around the world, saying Ian tends to be a pain in the ass unless you're kind of Gaelic.
Yeah, no, I just realised I've seen it different on different websites that I've been reading. What do you prefer? Because I was as your host, I'll stick with that.
Oh, no, well, you've started with Ian, so go with that. I'll answer to both. So
yeah, that's why we use Royal a lot, isn't it? Then you can't go wrong.
I'll do.
Yes, and so, what other expeditions have you done, or what led to the build up to this one?
Well, this is Summit to Sea's first major expedition. However, we did different British rivers from their highest sources as a lead up to it, but these were only like 2 or 3 day expeditions. This is the first major expedition. So we're both, you know, in slightly uncharted territory, but through, you know, a lot of good training in the Corps, and both of us being outdoorsmen and having the right people in the right place, it meant that we were already in a very good position to tackle this expedition and get it done. And we were in the process of doing that and in dealing with all the environmental problems that could have arisen. We were smashing it up until the unfortunate incident happened. So yeah, I'm pretty pleased that although this was the first expedition we were on track.
Sea to Summit, did I get that right? Summit to Sea. That makes more sense, doesn't it?
We're LCs, it's a lot easier for us to just to go downhill. We want it to start at the top and then just slowly go down.
That's like when I ran from John O'Groats to Land's End.
Downhill all the way.
Easy. I was going to say, who wants to do it uphill? Well, that didn't make any sense to me. So your website, friends at home, summittosea.org.uk. The charity was Royal Marines Charity.
Yeah, so initially we wanted to support Royal Marines Charity, who needed no introduction. RV1, who is a friend of ours from the Royal Marines, that they help with mental health issues with people in the southwest, and Rainforest Concern also, who fight to protect rainforests globally. And then once we'd started the expedition, we wanted to then support a local charity. But I can come on to that a bit later, because that's more. I'll tell you now. It's a charity called the Peru Mission, who aim to get into far-reaching corners of Peru and provide educational facilities in communities, which will hopefully stop these kids going into illegal activities like piracy, like illegal logging, mining. So yeah, after this accident happened, we decided that they'd be a good charity to support, considering we've seen some of the troubles out there now.
Mm. And drugs is big in that part of the world as well, is it not? The coca leaf.
Yeah. So between Peru and Colombia, I think that's where most of the cocaine comes from. There are a lot of cartels out there, so we hear, but actually I'm not sure if they really bother with tourists, and they've got bigger fish to fry, so I'm not sure if we encountered them. I think it was more just simple poor people that wanted to steal our things and sell them. I think that's probably how we saw it.
Yes. So let's talk about the logistics. So why did you come up with this idea, or how did you end up coming up with this idea, or settling on this mission?
So it was my dad actually that had this idea. He was a well-established climber back in the 60s and 70s, and he was doing a mountain called Hondoy in the Cordilla Blanca region of the Peruvian Andes. He was leading that expedition, and on that he met some people who had told about Chimborazo being the highest source of the Amazon, and then he went down into the Amazon and traveled through parts of it on his way home from that expedition. So he had this in his head, being a climber, that imagined doing this great river from its highest source. And then 2 years ago, when I was leaving the Corps, he sort of saw that I needed a project, so he passed that one on to me, because he'd never had the chance to do it due to many other exciting projects that he ended up doing. But yeah, from there I looked at it. And I was just captivated by it. Like Chimborazo, the summit of Chimborazo is the closest point on Earth to the sun, and it also feeds the Amazon River, which is the greatest river on the planet by far. The next seven biggest rivers combined don't put as much fresh water into the oceans as the Amazon does. So it's an amazing river, and the highest point on the planet of the Earth is the source of is a source of it. So what a journey to go from that point to the end point. And that was our goal.
Am I getting confused here? Was there a chap that walked it?
That was
a TV program, wasn't it?
Many, many, many people have in different ways, they have completed the Amazon from its longest source. So Ed Stafford's by far probably the most impressive, spent, I think, like 800 and something days, macheteing his way through the rainforest through, in incredibly tough conditions, compared with us floating down. What he did was an amazing achievement. But that was from a different starting point. So he was coming from South Peru, whereas we were coming from south of Ecuador. So we're doing it from the highest source. He has already done it from the longest source.
And is it, sorry, I wrote this down, Belém, is that the... Was that your destination?
Yeah.
So is that, what's that, east of Brazil?
That is, east coast Brazil, north Brazil,
North. Okay. I'm just trying to get the geography in my head. And yeah, Ed Stafford, he encountered a few challenges on that, did he not? I mean, he had the bot fly in his head. And he had to get a bit of super glue on a stick and stick it to the bot fly and pull the bloody thing out. And it was like about a little evil little thing about that big that he'd had in his head for a week.
Yeah. I'll get shot and have to do that.
Was it that expedition, or again, I might be confusing him, the one where he's with a chap or he's a couple of chaps and then we're walking along and one of them just died?
I'm not sure. I know for a quite a oh no, sorry. I'm not actually sure about that.
Yeah, friends at home, if you know the one I just remember watching this documentary. I feel sure it was that one, but he was walking along with this guy, and the guy just got heat stroke, and then the next thing you know, the chap just looks at the camera and says, "Right, so and so's just died. Not good." It's like, oh dear. Did you have any safety concerns? It's difficult, isn't it? When you plan an expedition, it's hard for the mind to contemplate it going wrong. And I've been on a few that have gone, you know, very wrong, you can say. I went on a diving expedition to Antarctica, and our first dive, one of our dive buddies drowned, and it was just, you know, you just never, well, you always think it's like possible, but I don't know, we never think it's going to happen to us, do we, you know?
No, exactly what you said. You know of the risks, but you assume that it won't happen to you, and it's always about other people in the newspaper. So when things do happen, it's a bit of a shock, but you're also, hopefully, you're prepared for it.
Yeah. Ian, what were your sort of major concerns, or what did you want to get right before you left?
Major concern, I think we didn't really know how we were going to react to the altitude going up Chimborazo. The other parts were, we weren't really concerned with the kind of two-legged problem. We didn't really think that. We thought it might be quite interesting meeting people and different communities, but I think before we left, we were more concerned with being so remote and then possibility of getting bitten by a snake. I met a good friend of mine, a guy called Liam Schneider, who's a fantastic doctor in Glasgow. He came along for the first chunk in the mountains with us. And we went through a lot of skill, you know, drills with him and how to, and different drugs that he had given us to help us out. But that was, I think, the forefront, because most likely situation was if one of us was bitten, we were pretty buggered, other than paddling hard to get out of there and trying to keep someone cool and, you know, IDing the snake, etc. So the rest of it, kind of the heat side of it, as you're saying, we were pretty hot on it with the, you know, having been LCs, being out in some pretty strong temperatures and around the world, knowing we just need to constantly cool off as soon as you feel hot or bothered. And your attitude is a big teller. Like if you're feeling down or angry, you just need to cool off. And we often, pretty much nearly four or five times a day towards the end of our episode there, we were just jumping in the water just to cool off.
You've got the Fer de Lance in that part of the world, is it not? One of the most poisonous. Yeah. It's only a tiny little thing. I mean, when it's curled up, it's no bigger than a circle that big, but they're are they not one of the most poisonous snakes on the planet?
Yeah, we were very lucky to met a mutual friend out in Peru in Iquitos, and he's actually got a sort of snake milking farm. He takes on any snakes that have been disturbed, or, you know, through, if you've got a deforestation, he'll take them on. Johnny and I are lucky enough to go to his farm with these snakes and actually hold the Verdelant snake, and a guy called Fernando Torres, and that was amazing. So one of the I think, I can't remember what this, the name of the other one is, Johnny, but it's two of the most poisonous snakes in the world, and I think the two most poisonous in South America. So,
yeah.
Yes. If they got that little horn thing on their nose, you just stay the fuck away from
it. Stay away from it.
And what about the actual transportation? Are you in separate canoes, or are you in the same canoe?
So it was canoes. The expedition started obviously with climbing the mountain, and then we had about 5 days walking, and then into the upper Pastaza. It's a very rough, big volume river, which comes out of Ecuador and goes into Peru. That was our route. So we were on whitewater rafts for 2 days because it was a better, more fun, and faster way of us getting down through a very remote part region, basically. And then from then on, we had a guy from Solango Kayaks in Quito that custom made us two Canadian canoes. And you can't really find Canadian canoes out there, and they're what we were comfortable with. So we found this guy. He makes sea kayaks. He ended up cutting these sea kayaks right down the middle, widening them, making custom-made bows and sterns for them, custom molds. So that was brilliant. We had our babies, like two really nice, custom-made canoes. So we're really pleased with them. And we got just to the close to the border, but still on the Ecuadorian side. And from then on, the water was flat, so we were able to take to the canoes. Hmm. And then for the next maybe month and a half, we were in two separate canoes. And then when we got to Iquitos, Ian and I sourced some local hardwoods and basically built these two canoes into a catamaran so we could sit next to each other and chat away through the long days and get breakfast on as we were going. So, yeah, we were slowly developing as we went. And it was a bit of a tip of the hat to the first conquistador, whichever went down in the Amazon, Francisco de Orellana, for him and his men to survive. They ended up building two big ships, which were then seaworthy, and they managed to sail them all the way down the Amazon and up into the Caribbean to after they were separated from an expedition. So we were, it was kind of us trying to do the same, like making our little boat.
And what equipment? I'm guessing you took a machete.
Yeah, machete, hatchet, pruning saw. I even took some secateurs, which were a complete waste of space. But I just thought, you never know, I might do a spot of gardening while I'm there. Yeah.
Samwise Gamgee.
Yeah, we had some of that. And you get machetes everywhere there. You know, they're like, it's like wearing a watch. Pretty much everyone carries a machete, which is, you know, fair enough, because I'm constantly in the bush hacking away.
My son put this on my desk early. My son's 8. He loves his knife. This is a puss. Is what is it? Like a parang, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I bought this ages ago at a bushcraft festival. It was like about £6 or something. I thought, got to just buy it, right? But there we go. But the funny thing is, the machete that I bought in Ecuador, probably 20 years ago now, which costs like £2 in the market, is way better than this shit.
You want a longer blade, and that's a lot heavier. Like, most of the stuff you're going through is really thin. That's almost better for chopping a thick branch than the machetes that they have out there for small stuff are all bigger and a lot thinner metal.
Yeah, I find with the machete, I can't really describe it, but you can get hell of a chop on it. Yeah. It flies through the air. And you see guys down there, don't you? They've sharpened them so much that they're no longer that fat. They look like a carving knife.
Yeah.
What about malaria? Was that a concern?
Shall I continue on equipment briefly? Because we had the watch I'm wearing now, actually, and the Garmin Mini InReach were really important for us, and we were very fortunate when we were planning this. I had an interview with Chris Tyso, who owns Tysos, which is a big Scottish outdoor company, up in Scotland mostly, and he agreed to sponsor us for all of our equipment. So we've got a huge thank you to Tysos for giving us all of our equipment, which turned into really good clothing from Berghaus, footwear from Scarpa, and the electronics and things from Garmin. So we're hugely fortunate with that, and without that partnership, we probably wouldn't have been there yet. We'd have still been trying to get there. So yeah, big shout out to them, seeing as we can here.
Yes, no, good effort. I mean, that's the funding and equipment is the two things that hold most expeditions back, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a dream come true to have someone do all your kit for you.
I'll take your prompt on funding as well. We did two fundraisers prior to it, and it was almost all of the funding has been through generous friends. We held auctions, and we put up a just giving, and the friends in Edinburgh and Exeter made this happen as well. That was all of our funding. We didn't have a private cash sponsor, so it's just purely the great community around us that came together and enabled us to get out there. So thank you to everyone that donated.
Yes, there's some kind people out there. It's also people see a good thing and, you know, I don't know, what do you call it? Adventuring by proxy. So yes, good effort.
So going on, you were asking about malaria side. Basically, we took Malarone, and that seemed to work fine for both of us. We also had, which we kept to one side because it's quite a dynamic use. Was it antibiotic? The doxycycline. So we had that to one side, just because we didn't want to be taking that every day in case we got another infection. And that's quite a decent way of clearing it out. So we had Malarone and basically a very good, very comprehensive med kit. And a lot of that. Who's the company that supplied that, Johnny? Can you remember? Sorry.
So Liam, the doctor, managed to get all of our med equipment from MD Pharmacy. So they supplied us a great big bag full of antibiotics and other bits and bobs. And then Master also supplied us with a lot of good stuff like mosquito nets and bandages and personal, small personal first aid kits with all the little things that you'd need.
What about painkillers, especially with what happened to you? Did you have anything strong?
We had some pretty strong stuff, which it was our kind of go-to because I had some serious stomach cramps at one point. I just looked like a pale golem-like creature, like clawing out of this pretty stinking barge that we were on to try and get down this dangerous part of the river. And my stomach was cramping to, you know, sort of next level, the pain that I had rarely felt before. So I had some dihydrocodeine, which proper knocks you out. It's great. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I had that in my wash kit ready to go. Obviously, won't go into too much until you've asked the questions. I had it next to the wash kit ready to go. So when eventually I took the pistol off Johnny and put it in there from the incident, I was like, oh, yeah, and take these, mate. So I had a couple just to pop in his mouth, which I think numbed it for him a little bit.
Did the job for sure.
that's what we call DF-118s in the Corps, was it not?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
They're strong anyway. But yeah, I think we were able to get quite a lot from Liam, and he told us when to take them. But we had paracetamols and all the rest of it for other things. But these were definitely good for the more serious occasions.
And what about your sleeping arrangements?
Almost all in hammocks. The first month maybe was more intense as we were up in the mountains in Ecuador. But as soon as we were onto the river, it was finding trees or buildings that we could sling our hammocks in.
And when you're making these transitions between the mountains and the lowlands, had you stationed your different bits of kit along the route, or did you take everything from the beginning?
Basically, our base was in a place called Banos, and we'd befriended a really nice guy who owns a hostel called Montano, was it? Montano Hostel. So we were able to store all of our jungle kit with him and then go up and do the mountains. And then once we were basically going to be walking straight past him, we could then switch the kit around, and so we weren't having to carry everything up everywhere we were going. And then once we'd finished the mountain stage as well, two of the team members, Ben and Liam, were going from separate points, so they were able to take a lot of our mountain kit away, leaving us with just what we needed for the forest. Like, people are too busy these days anyway. I mean, that's one of the reasons we wanted to go on an expedition and get away from the sort of lifestyle of just how we are always on our screens and,
yeah,
you know, flicking through things before you actually see if it's worth being interested in. But like, if you have a tag like the Royal Marines, a lot of people are very interested in the Royal Marines. And if you've got a good story about the Corps, then that's where you found your listeners. So I suppose you need that headline. We wanted to talk about mental health before we went out as well. And reiterating again, that's one of probably the main reason that I wanted to do this expedition, is because I'd gone through 8 years looking for excitement in the Corps and not got as much as I'd wanted. And I was pretty down. I just felt like I wasn't suited for this kind of modern life. So, well, I guess what I was saying in short is get off the screens and get out into the hills. And that's how you motivate yourself. If you can, and if you can't, hopefully you've got an opportunity for somebody to help you and take you there. But if you can get out there and do it, because that's where all the motivation and the inspiration comes in, from actually doing things yourself.
Yeah, I guess that was the point I was making, isn't it? Is you get to the end of your life and you don't want to look back and think all I did was surf other people's heroics on YouTube. But I actually got out there and made plans myself, and it doesn't have to be anything. You don't have to do what you guys are doing.
No.
But even just doing a parachute jump is like a massive thing is a massive achievement, or running a half marathon or whatever it might, you know, whatever it might be. But when you guys left the Corps, did you have any challenges adapting to Civvy Street?
No, not, I didn't personally. I know a lot of guys do. I've always had a very strong friend base, not just from the Marines, but from home as well. And I kind of had a bit of an idea as to my purpose. And I guess the challenges I was facing in the Marines weren't quite enough for me. And I was kind of looking for more, so I've made my peace with that. And sort of going on with the mental health side of things, I think I was always going to push myself in some way, find a challenge, find something to be, you know, scared about, rather than being scared of an email that comes up on your phone, or, you know, worried about what the bloody neighbour thinks, or, you know, and this is so sort of endemic in our society today, is this anxiety kind of festival that's going on. Like, I'm anxious of this, I'm anxious of that. And it's, you know, you should be anxious of things that, you know, anxiety is completely normal reaction to things, you know. You know, be anxious about coming on a podcast and worried how I might look and the rest of it. But, you know, to be anxious of a beep on your phone, you kind of got to put it into some perspective. Like, you're going to need to go find a challenge out there to then make you realize that all of that kind of admin and guess like social media and all that, all the technology out there now and the way we're kind of getting pushed is basically a load of bullshit. You know, if you want to be anxious about something, go and get in the sea, or you find a challenge, or find something where you've got to rely on your wits, and, you know, your body's getting a hammering, and then go home and switch your phone off and just chill out, you know. leaving the Corps, no. I was in quite a fortunate position, basically. But I certainly know a lot of guys that have left and do struggle, for sure.
Yes, yes. How about you, John?
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate as well. As Ian said, a lot of people have left and really struggled with PTSD and other things. So I certainly didn't have that, but I was definitely down for a couple of years after it. But I don't attribute that to leaving the Corps. I attribute that to something else. Like, just to reiterate, going on this expedition gets you out of that hole, and or planning to do it gets you out of the hole, and doing all the pre-expeditions leading up to this expedition, that's what makes you happy. The fizz releases the endorphins and you feel happier, and you're more motivated to do things in the evenings that aren't just scrolling or watching Netflix. You've had your fizz and it makes you want to do blogs, or, I don't know, things that are more important, or even just getting through getting all your HMRC admin done or something. At least you can do it on a bit of a buzz from having done some fizz. So, yeah, like I don't think myself is suited to the modern life that we lead, like emails and all that stuff. So if anything, I'm running away from that by doing expeditions. And if we can somehow make a career of that, then great, I'll be a happy man.
So back to the expedition. Can you talk us through when a pissed up pirate tried to steal all your stuff and then he shot you twice?
I'll kick off, I guess. We kind of both had different roles in the whole situation, so we'll bounce off each other here, I guess. But yeah, we left Iquitos, where we'd been for quite some time, and spent 4 days going down river and past a place called Pebas.
Complexion of a what's that guy's name?
A sack of a man.
Who's the Sundance kid? What's the actor?
Robert Redford.
There you go.
Oh, mate, I'll take that. We'll take you.
We stayed there. I can't remember the dates now, that night, and left there early that morning. And we'd been told by the guy that we'd stayed with in Pebas that if you go downstream, you will probably die, but you get told that all the time. And people have a lot of different fears on the Amazon. So we just took it as another one of those and continued downstream. And after a little while, we were approached by a peki-peki boat, which is a boat that they used to... Well, it's just a local canoe, basically, a long 7-meter canoe with an outboard engine on the back. And these guys kind of approached and stopped. And then I got a bit closer and stopped. And they were right on our stern, which is quite unusual because the river is about 1,500 meters, maybe wider at that point. So if you're going up and down river, there's no need to be right on somebody's stern, but they were right behind us. So our hackles were raised by that point. And then they pulled alongside us. As we've mentioned, we were in a catamaran, so I was on the left-hand hull. Ian was on the right. They pulled along the left-hand side. And we had about maybe 5 to 10 minute conversation with them in very broken Spanish. And I think he was just using that time to look in our boat and see if we had weapons or see if we were worth the admin of Robin. We had a lot of bags with us, so he, you know, but we'd covered up any expensive equipment, but he must have saw the bags and thought, it's worth it. We didn't have our machetes on show either. So long story short, he pulled his pistol. But by this time, he was directly behind us, sort of between the two of us. I pulled his weapon out, and Ian came in with a throat shot with a paddle, basically. So I'll let you take over there, yeah.
He was kind of making motions for us to go off down the smaller part of the river. So imagine a massive island right in front of us. And he wanted us to go down the left-hand side, which was out of the flow of the river. Still probably bigger than the Thames, but it's the smaller part of the river. He was doing that, and we basically said no. And I think he was beginning to piss us both off. There he then basically stood up and pulled a pistol out. And sort of before he could get up on aim, I think that's probably what I was thinking about. He wanted to point the thing at me. I sort of struck him with my paddle high up in the chest. And then me and John had discussed kind of, I guess, the best way we can kind of get out of that situation if there's armed or just aggressive men. We're both pretty big, you know, big lads compared to most Peruvians, a lot heavier, and we're both very comfortable in the water. So sort of came up with a bit of a very rough plan of, well, we'll, you know, hit him with our paddles and then dive underwater and just capsize their boat, and then we're kind of more in an even playing field. Obviously, when I was talking to John about that, I had no idea that was actually going to happen. And luckily, I reacted like that and, you know, hit him in the, high up, and then dove underwater, came up on the other side. But in that time, so I didn't hear any gunshots at all. So I was completely unaware that until we were getting back in our canoes at the end, I was completely unaware that John had even been shot. Whereas John heard all 5 gunshots, 2 of them going straight through him. So, but yeah, I came up on the other side, of the boat, pulled it down with all my weight, essentially doing a kind of a muscle up from the water, which is obviously a hell of a lot easier, but pulled it down quite violently just to try and capsize them. At that moment, I'm pretty sure the guy in the engine went into the water. And as I came up onto the boat and as it's filling water, I grabbed the gunman and had a bit of a wrestle with him from a slightly precarious position. As the boat was then kind of going over, because it just had its complete full then, and we were going into the water, that's when John came up like some sort of shark and just plunged this guy under and just got on with the job of disarming him. But I'll let John go back into his bit, because obviously we had to patch this together a few times after it happened, because it was so quick and the adrenaline is you're off your head, you know, on adrenaline. So you kind of try to patch it together afterwards. It's just, it was quite hard work actually. But yeah, John, sorry.
Like Ian said, his reaction to stop the guy from aiming the pistol initially probably saved one of us from, you know, getting a nastier shot. And as soon as he's done that, I've just advanced on the guy as well. I guess when the guy sort of regained himself after the initial stagger, he's fired a shot, which didn't hit anyone. I presumed it was aimed at Ian. And then the second shot, I think I've just grabbed, by the time I've grabbed him, he's managed to get his weapon around, and the second shot's gone through my shoulder. And then I've gone straight into the water. I just remember being in the water under their boat, thinking like, which side of their boat am I going to come up on? Because the guy's probably waiting just to shoot me in the head when I do surface. Also, like I've been saying as well, there was no pain. Like the adrenaline was massive, and it didn't hit anything serious. It hit a nerve, I guess, which maybe even made it less painful, because I don't know. There was very little pain anyway, and I was able to use my body, which was great. And then I came up the other side, the same side that Ian had come up on, and just saw them scuffling. So plunged the guy under. And I think my idea was to drown him, just had my hand on his head, pushing him under. And then I felt another sort of jolt through my body. I was like, shit, I've been shot again. This can't happen again. So I just followed, basically trained my hands down his shoulder in the murky water. Eyes open, you couldn't see anything. So I was on a guess. I followed my hands down his arm, found luckily that was the arm with the weapon in it, and just twisted it out of his hand. And two more shots were fired as that happened. And then just kicked away from him. Really, really delighted to have a weapon. It kind of felt like we're in control now. And the fear was kind of gone. Came up and surfaced and looked at the guy for a second, and Ian was to my left, and he shouted, "Let's go," and swam back quickly. In all honesty, the weapon fired twice underwater, and then it jammed. So if it hadn't have jammed, who knows what would have happened. But luckily it did, and we swam back, got in our boat, and found out we had four rounds left, which was, again, great. A great feeling, like, because we didn't know if there was other pirates in the area or if the place where we were going to get help, we didn't know if they were going to be hostile or not either. So it was really nice to know that we had four rounds. But that was kind of the end of it. We're back in the boat and paddling as hard as we could to a community downstream.
How did they receive you?
Really well, really nice people. And yeah, like for anyone that's watching that's thinking about going to Peru, don't let this make a decision otherwise. Like, it's a great place to go. People are lovely. You can go on adventure holidays there and never see any trouble. We were on a expedition far, far away from any of the tourist destinations, and that's where these things can happen. But if you want to go to Iquitos or Lima, You should definitely go. You'll go and you'll have a great time, and the people are good. The food is amazing. So keep that in mind. Don't let this scare you off South America.
When did the pain start kicking in?
It didn't really too bad, because I had we got into the canoe, and then like Ian had said earlier, he basically gave me a couple of these dihydracodeine thing straight away. So I went from adrenaline into being in a quite a nice, chilled out state. And both shots, as I said, were really lucky. The one in my thigh went through my thigh muscle and out the other side. So it was completely just a flesh wound. And this one snapped a nerve. So maybe that made it even less painful because there was no way for the nerve to tell my brain that it was sore. I'm not sure about that. But yeah, I was pretty much, well, I wasn't pain free, but it was not, you know, not what you'd think.
Yeah. Did the one in your shoulder lodge in there?
No, both went straight through. I mean, yeah, there's like forgetting about all this information now, but when I was swimming back, I had the weapon in my hand and I was thinking, both of those shots felt like a jolt, but I feel fine and my body's working. And I looked down at the weapon, it's just a small weapon. I was thinking it must be a BB gun or something. And then when I got in, I told Ian I'd been shot, and he saw the exit wound in my back and we're like, oh shit, like this is obviously a powerful weapon. Going back to Jan again, once we got to the shore, he was all over it with the med kit, wrapping me up with, because you know, although there wasn't much blood or pain, it still needed pressure and everything else. So he was straight in with that, and we'd had good medical training in the Corps and then from Liam earlier in the expedition. So Ian was all over it, making sure that I was I was fine. I didn't have to do much. I lay back and let him tie towels around me.
Did you start on the antibiotics, or did you wait till you got to the hospital?
As we were paddling towards the community, Ian did the lion's share of the paddling, because I was getting a little bit less and less able. And I was sending out SOSs to our friends in Iquitos and to Garmin emergency response, who they were both brilliant, and they liaised with our emergency contacts back home, and everyone sort of came together to send us the best support. So as soon as we arrived at the community, and within 3 hours the Peruvian Navy had sent an armada of support, like hospital ship, gunboats, special like SEALs came in to help, and they brought a couple of field medics, and then they basically got a drip in and put me straight on antibiotics and then redid my bandaging. And then the Navy gunboat that had a small infirmary, and it took us all the way back to Iquitos, all for nothing, like just purely out of, knew that we were Marines and they were, you know, they were Peruvian Navy. So that really, really huge thank you to them as well for doing that and really asking for nothing from us, just wanted to help us out.
Did you know that this was going to put you guys on hold for a bit?
I think it took me about 2 days to realize we were on hold. I kind of thought, I was trying to think of ways where we could just get in a fast boat and somehow complete it. But we'd both made a promise to each other. We were going to paddle the whole of the Amazon, which is from basically Nauta, which is just upstream of Iquitos, all the way to the mouth. So we'd made promises to each other, and there was like, oh well, we've been shot, so maybe it's a bit of an excuse to get it done quickly. But Ian quite sensibly said like we need to go back, and we really did need to go back because I needed the surgery for a start, but also we needed to go and reassure our families, like they had seen this SOS come through, and for quite a few hours they didn't have a clue if we were alive or dead, and they just saw this sort of blinking thing in the middle of the river, and then they started hearing information like gunshots and emergency medical emergency, and we weren't there to reassure them, and we weren't able to reassure them. So about a day had gone past, we got into the Wi-Fi and we were able to see all these messages, and it was pretty harrowing reading them all of our family members trying to ascertain what had happened from each other. So we wanted to go back and reassure them for sure, and I needed to obviously get surgery in the end, so it's a good thing we did.
Where did you fly home from?
We both went into Lima, and then Ian was able to get Lima to, I can't remember, what was your route, Ian?
To London, Lima, Bogota, and then London Heathrow.
And I spent a couple of days in Lima because my options were better, to go to Edinburgh a few days later. So But that was after a week of recovering together, and we're both in a good place. I met a friend in Lima, which I met up with from the Marines as well. Yeah, and then we got home, and it was nice seeing everyone, but I'm kind of itching to get away from all the emails.
Yes, I bet. What was it like dealing with all the media?
How do we answer this, Ian?
You can imagine it's fraught with it's like snakes and ladders, isn't it? It's more snakes than ladders, I'd say. But no, it's fine.
I'll put it this way: the articles that went out and the interviews that the BBC in particular did with me, they really got our messages right, and I think they were all very good. But I was a bit annoyed with some of the headlines in the newspapers. Like we gave quotes, and then they changed the quotes but leave the quotation marks, and they say, like, I think one of them said, like, I had said, I'm a Marine and this kind of shit doesn't happen to me, something like that. It was just like, I did not say that.
Hey mate, welcome to my world.
Drama. So yeah,
the most important thing is that you guys are still smiling. Fellas, what's the game plan then?
Looking at getting a team together, a 6-man minimum team, really, to go back out with. We want to be a big footprint to deter this kind of thing from happening again. And as we go further down the river and into Brazil, there's more reports of these kind of things happening. So we need to make sure we've got the right team and the right SOPs, I guess, in case this kind of thing does happen, and the right equipment. So we go back to not square one, but we go back to planning again. We need to fundraise a lot. We need a financial sponsor. We have a brilliant equipment sponsor in Tyso who will continue to support us. We need a financial sponsor, and this could be a partnership that would go into the three longest rivers from their highest sources, which is in the game plan to do the Nile and the Yangtze from their highest sources. So we want to get this one done. We want to do it within 12 months' time, ideally as soon as possible. We're looking for a team. If you're up to the job, get in touch. You can find details through the website, which is going to be at the bottom of the link, if you said.
Have you got a fundraiser?
We're on Just Giving, which I'll send that link to you as well to put at the bottom.
Yes, I'm just looking at it. Just looking at it now.
That's getting split 60-40, so 60% of your donation will be given to the expedition and 40% will go to charity. So if that link could go at the bottom, great as well. And if for any potential donators, thank you very much.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Folks, you heard it. Get on the case. Well, guys,
help us finish it, please.
Yeah, well, I hope this... I have no doubt you're going to finish it. Expedite things if the good people out there would come and support you. Friends, we're going to put a link below for the Just Giving page. I'm looking at it now. Both Ian and John, massive, massive thank you. I wish you all the best. If there's any way I can help, please, don't hesitate to ask. And
thanks very much for having us on, mate.
Absolutely. My pleasure. My pleasure. Friends at home, much, much love to you all. Please, please look after yourselves. If you can chuck the podcast a like, that would be really appreciated. And if you can make sure you subscribe, that also helps. Cheers, cheers. Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pair.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.